So first I should say congratulations. I take it you're all holding an offer from our department to join the program next year, and that's already a great achievement. So congratulations, nice to see you here. Hope you have a nice afternoon. So this is what I want to do today. I know that given that you're at this stage of your undergraduate or prospective studies, you probably don't need to hear that much about what's distinctive about philosophy at the LIC, because I'm sure you've done your research already, but I will say a couple of words about that before we get started. And then the main thing is just to do a sample lecture today, right? Just, you know, enjoy a little bit of philosophy together. And then I'll recap our BSc programs and give you some time for questions. So, why study here? Well, you know, we don't like to gloat, but we're very well ranked internationally by the sort of standard international ranking, the LITER report. Specifically for our specialties, which are philosophy of science, as I'm sure you're aware of, rational choice and game theory, right, that's sort of top five business worldwide. But we're also strong in moral and political philosophy and in philosophy of public policy, which is a unique program here at the LIC, mainly at the master's level, I should say, but the course is offered at the undergraduate level as well. The department's growing. I fall down here in the list. It's getting a little bit professor-heavy, bit top-heavy these days, which I don't know is good for someone like me, but the department is growing. Things are happening. We always have a number of visiting professors around as well, and also some teaching fellows supplementing our teaching. And, you know, we always say this, but it is very meaningful and very distinct about the department here, right? It's not something just to reel off. And that is that we have this quite specific approach to philosophy within the international philosophy community, right? There's only a few other philosophy departments worldwide who we would say really share this approach fully, and that is that the department's very cohesive to start with. There's a very sort of common approach to methodology and common sort of outlook on philosophy without being overly narrow. And in particular, we think that philosophy can be and should be viewed as an intellectual activity continuous with science. Right, and that, of course, issues of natural and social science or philosophy of the natural and social sciences benefit from this approach, but so too does moral philosophy, political philosophy, and public policy. Right? We're not into sort of cooping ourselves up in armchairs and playing clever games with each other. Philosophy has value precisely because it is continuous with the sciences and has a lot to offer in terms of methodology of the sciences. And underlying assumptions in public policy. Right? Lots happening around the department that students are welcome to engage in, sort of weekly seminars, both from the rational choice, moral political end, also from the philosophy of science end, departmental seminars, workshops, also for students, a special student conference that's held yearly, and also now a special conference for the first year students at the end of their introductory philosophy course on reason, knowledge, and values. Also, again, I mean, we're not embarrassed about talking about career prospects for students here. I mean, people in the past, I think, tend to think, oh, philosophy is sort of a non-career option. But that's really so far from the truth these days. And we're particularly proud of the fact that the department sort of trains you up for, in terms of essay, argumentative writing skills, analytic skills, as well as quantitative skills, whether you're in the straight philosophy program or the philosophy and economics program. You will, everyone at least has to do logic. There's the opportunity to do other quantitative courses. It turns out to be a very nice mix, and one that employers do recognize. Okay, but let's get on to a lecture. So I'm going to talk about a very traditional philosophy topic, right? One that's been with us for a long time. There's a huge literature on this topic, but I can't really hope to do justice to in this setting. But it continues to be a puzzle amongst philosophers, also cognitive scientists, neuroscientists, to some extent social scientists more broadly. And in fact, a couple of members of the department have written on this topic fairly recently. Professor Mike Otsuka and more recently Professor Christian List have offered positions on the problem of free will. Right. So the problem is most commonly thought of as sort of how do we accommodate free will in our picture of the universe that modern science gives us? That's the problem, often posed as how can we have free will in a deterministic universe? But I'll get to that shortly. Okay, so this is the order of events. First, I'll say a bit about what free will is, what I'm talking about here, why anyone should care about it, and then we'll get to the problems that there might be associated with free will. Okay, so what is free will? Well, in simple terms, it's just the ability to freely choose our own actions, right? So there's two parts to that, choosing our own actions, sort of the will part, and doing it freely. So the free part is commonly cashed out as you could have done otherwise, right? Now this is in a very local setting, so we're not interested in freedom more broadly when we're considering this puzzle, right? We're not concerned about how much freedom, for instance, British citizens have compared to North Korean citizens, right? We're not interested in the extent of your political freedom, we're just interested in whether there's at least some scope for freedom on a very local, intimate level. Could you have chosen otherwise than what you choose at any particular point in time? And the other part's also very important. So we're interested in your own actions, intentional actions, things that you decide to do given your own beliefs and desires, right? As opposed to compulsive activity from addiction, say. There's some famous cases that neuroscientists have been interested in where people do sort of very horrible acts, and later it turns out that they had a tumour that was affecting them, right? And that people think was the cause of the act. These kinds of compulsive acts are not ones that are considered in character, or they're not arising from the beliefs and desires, the stable beliefs and desires of the person, right? Not considered to be their own act. So you can see there's a link between choosing freely or the ability to act otherwise and intentional acts that arise from your own beliefs and desires. In cases where you have a tumor that's compelling you to do things, we tend to think you couldn't do otherwise. The act wasn't intentional and you couldn't do otherwise. Now, these debates get a bit academic, but just to sort of really experience what we understand to be free will, I want you to just do this exercise with me, right? And I want you to turn to the person next to you, and on the count of three, I want you to play a game of
paper, rock, scissors with them, right? Where you need to choose which hand signal you should do. It's either rock, paper, or scissors. You all know that game? Right. Now, the game is, of course, that paper beats rock, rock beats scissors. What's the other one?
Scissors beats paper.
Scissors beats paper, that's right. So the point is, you know, just think in your mind, like, I'm about to make a decision, what's it going to be? Bang. Right? On the count of, when I say three, you have to do it. Okay, so you either do that, that, or that. Right. Okay, ready? All set? Okay. One, two, three. Okay, yeah, that was a practice. That was a practice. So I have to be more ordered in my count. Okay, ready? Okay. So it goes like this. One, two, three. One, two, three. Okay. So you can tally the winnings by yourselves, right? Now, the idea, just to go through that, is first to get it clear that that's the level of freedom that we're talking about, just this intimate level of choosing an act, right? Not this broad issue of political freedom. And the question is, did you feel like you could have done otherwise in that situation? I mean, you chose one thing. No doubt you were influenced by maybe the other person's facial expression, your beliefs about what they might choose. I mean, the expert players have a lot of sort of guessing of what each other are going to do, right? But at the end of the day, I mean, did you feel like you could do either rock, paper, or scissors? You weren't compelled to do any of them. I think this is a very sort of compelling intuition that we have. Okay, and why should we care that we have that sort of choice? Well, I think it's very much tied up with our sense of who we are as persons, right? We think of ourselves as agents, persons. We have a psychological life that depends very much on the fact that we think we can choose at different points of time what it is that we're going to do, at least at a local level, right? Whatever pervasive social forces there might be. It's also very important in science for decision making, or the idea of decision making, rational choice. Economics, for instance, premised on sort of choices of agents, use models that presume that people have a choice as what to choose. Right. I think most importantly, people worry about the implications for moral responsibility. Right. We do, you know, for better or worse, do a lot of praising and blaming in this world, right? Blaming other people for their actions, holding them responsible for bad deeds, for sort of not being reliable enough, for not being thoughtful enough, and so on and so forth. And many people think that it only makes sense to hold people responsible for things if we really think that they were the author of their actions and they could have done otherwise. Otherwise, this common practice of moral responsibility might just turn out to be nonsensical, right? And this is kind of worrying for our social life, as well as our sense of self. So much of the consequence of the debate about free will has to do with moral responsibility, right? You should always bear in mind why it is that you're interested in what follows from the answers that I give to a particular philosophical position. What are the consequences of my position on free will? Well, moral responsibility is pretty much where it's at.
Now, I'll continue to raise the issue of moral responsibility as we go along. Okay. So what is the threat from modern science to our concept of free will, or the presence of free will, right? Our having free will, being able to choose freely in the world. Well, the crux of the argument is pretty much this, right? This is the argument that's been bothering people for ages and that people give different responses to, right? Or they critique it at different places and come up with different responses to the puzzle. Now, I'm going to go through it carefully, but let's just appreciate the whole argument first, right? So the first premise is just an aspect of free will that I've already mentioned, and that is that an act is chosen freely only if one could have done otherwise, right? Or being able to do otherwise, many people think, is a necessary component of acting freely. I also mentioned earlier the intentional, agential aspect, but being able to do otherwise, at least a necessary component, right? Now, the second premise, many people also think that if determinism is true, and I'll explain determinism shortly, then in fact one could not ever do otherwise than what one does. Which leads to the conclusion of incompatibilism, that determinism is not compatible with free will, right? Just a limited conclusion, doesn't say anything beyond that. Just incompatibilism is that, okay, if determinism's true, then we don't have free will, right? That conclusion follows from those premises, does look to be so, if you eyeball it for a second. Okay, so let's examine it a little bit further. So determinism. If determinism is true, one couldn't act otherwise than what how one acts, right? So what's determinism? I think the way to think about determinism is just to think of the evolution of the universe from the Big Bang, whatever the origins are, following a single train track that is set by the deterministic laws of nature. Right? They're deterministic because there's only one way that the evolution of the universe could go. Right? So determinism is a thesis about the laws of nature. It says that if you know the conditions of the universe at any particular point along the track, and you know the laws of nature, right? Or given the way the world is and the laws of nature, there's only one way that the universe can be in the next moment, right? And so on and so forth. So there's only one way it can be in the next moment, and then the laws of nature will determine what it will be in the next moment, and so on. So actually, if we know the state of the universe at any point in time, and we know the laws of the universe, we can map out the entire universe or the entire train track that's the evolution of the universe. And that actually goes backwards as well as forwards if you think the laws of nature are symmetrical in that way. So basically everything was already, the causal pathway just unravels only in one way right from the start, from the Big Bang. Now, the second, that's determinism. That's just the definition of determinism. What does it mean for the laws of nature to be deterministic? Right? That's what it means. It means that given any particular moment and the laws of nature, there's just one way it can all unravel, backwards and forwards. Okay. Now, why does that mean that you couldn't act otherwise? Well, you might think that's obvious, right? Given that I just said there's sort of one way that laws can unravel. But the idea is that, you know, this means that all the bits of nature, all the particles, all the rocks, the trees when they finally appear in the evolution of the universe, humans, can only ever follow one causal trajectory. Right? If you think our mental life is, at the end of the day, underpinned by physical processes, neurons firing, stuff like this, then those neurons were always going to fire.
those emotions you had underpinned by those mental, physical, mental processes were always going to occur as they occurred in the causal chain that was inevitable from the Big Bang. So there was just one way that things could turn out to be. Now, you know, and this gained a lot of traction in the days of Newton, when he did seem to come up with physical laws that governed all of nature in this way, like simple laws of motion that applied to everything. Now, I'll mention indeterminism a bit later, but at the moment we're in the realm of determinism, right? So in the realm of determinism, what you did before in terms of rock, paper, scissors, set in stone from the start of the universe, right? What was always going to happen that way. You saw it, you know, what are they going to do? Maybe I'll do this. Always was going to happen like that, right? At the physical level. Okay, so that's the premise about determinism, right? That, okay, if the world is deterministic, there's a sense in which you couldn't do other than what you did, that you were always going to choose rock, paper, or scissors just now. I was always going to turn up here. You were always going to make the various complex sequences of decisions that landed you in this room right now. Now, let me just say a little bit more about the conclusion, okay? So some people think that the natural conclusion then is that determinism is not compatible with free will. That's fine, given the way we have posed free will in the earlier premises of that argument. Now, what do they then say? Well, some people still hold out hope for the kind of free will that appeared in the earlier premises, right? The kind of free will that meant that at the very physical level, at the level of neurons firing, you could have done otherwise than what you did, right? And so they think, oh, well, maybe indeterminism can help us out here, right? You know, indeterminism might be our last hope for free will. Okay, free will's not compatible with determinism, but maybe, you know, with any luck, and quantum mechanics seems to show that this may not be so far-fetched, indeterminism will help us out. Now, the problem with that move, and I'm not going to say too much about it, is it's unclear whether that actually does help us out. How does, let's take quantum mechanics, the idea of some laws being probabilistic, or there being an element of randomness at the subatomic level, how does the presence of randomness really help us to control our actions such that we have free will? Right? It may help the could have done otherwise part, but it doesn't seem to help the us being the author of our actions in a way that free will requires, just the presence of sort of random knocks in the system, right? I mean, that, if anything, seems to detract from our free will. So that's the worry about the indeterminism line. So, you know, determinism might not be compatible with free will, but maybe indeterminism's not either. But some people, I should say, still pursue that line and argue that it is, or they argue that mental events lie outside the physical realm and explore that line of reason. Of course, the other thing you could do is just say free will. Who needs it, right? Okay, there's a good chance the universe turns out to be deterministic or indeterministic, doesn't matter, either way. Free will of the kind that means being able to do otherwise is just a fiction, right? And, you know, maybe they want to say we should then, if that should give us pause in terms of assigning responsibility to people. Certainly at the ultimate level of thinking, just to use the religious phrase as a metaphor, in the matter of heaven or hell, right, that kind of responsibility is just not appropriate because we're all victims in the causal chain. Right? victims as much as the person with the tumour who throws their wife out of a window. Unfortunately, I think that was one of the cases. That person was a victim of compulsion, and we are also victims of the causal chain elicited from the Big Bang. Right? Maybe that's the lesson to be learned.
Now, people don't settle on that. There's some people are what's known as compatibilists, and how do they do this? What they do is they return to the premises and smarten them up a little bit so that we don't get the incompatibilist conclusion. Right? So they mess with the premises. They mess with what it means to be able to do otherwise in order to have free will. So they say a common move in this way is, no, it's not just an act is chosen freely if one could have done otherwise, you know, in the great chain of the universe. It's rather an act is chosen freely if one could have done otherwise if one wanted to, right? Now, it so happens that, of course, I did want to do whatever I'm doing right now, given the cause of the universe. I was always going to want that. But if I wanted to do something else, I would have done it. And that's what we mean by free will. And that's fine. That's totally compatible with determinism. Right. So my character is inevitable. I was always going to be the sort of person I am right now. But that's okay, because free will just means if I had a different character, I would have done something else. And that's compatible with determinism. Determinism says I wasn't going to have a different character, but if I did, I could have done something else. That's the idea. And people who pursue this line think, in fact, this is all we need for the kinds of practices of holding people morally responsible that we commonly engage in. Right. We're just interested in whether people did things intentionally in a way that flowed from their character. We're not interested in whether sort of ultimately they're to blame or to praise for their character. Right? Intentious.
Now, the picture there is of Martin Luther, who's very commonly cited in the literature of free will, and that's because people quote him under pressure from the Catholic Church, who has made all these demands for reform back in the day, and under pressure from the Catholic Church as to, you know, why did you do that? He famously said, or probably didn't say, probably was just attributed as saying, "Here I stand, and I could do no other." And the reason compatibilists refer to this is because it's clear that Martin Luther wasn't trying to sort of wipe his hands of responsibility for all of the protesting that he did of the Catholic Church and their ways and practices. He was clearly taking ownership, right? He was saying, look, this is flowing from my character. I couldn't have done otherwise than what I did. I just had to rebel against these practices. And I'm proud of it, and I'll take responsibility too, thanks very much.
Another type of response, and again, I can only sketch this just briefly, but this is one offered recently by my colleague, Professor Christian List, and that's to sort of discriminate between the sciences for which determinism holds and the sciences for which determinism doesn't necessarily hold.
Right.
So he is focused on the determinism case. And his point is that, look, even if the world is deterministic at the level of basic particles, at the level of fundamental physics, right, that doesn't mean that at the level of economics, where we talk about humans, we don't talk about electrons, or at the level of psychology or other social sciences, that those sciences which supervene
to use a technical word, on the physical universe are also deterministic. We might have, at one and the same time, the best psychological description of the universe is not deterministic, even though the best physics description of the universe is deterministic or indeterministic. It doesn't really matter, but the point is that the two don't need to go in tandem. Now, that's quite a complex point that has to do with the relationship between the sciences and the extent to which we think that the higher sciences that deal with complex stuff like humans and psychology should be reduced at the level of explanation to the lower sciences. So he's trading on some issues in philosophy of science there.
And he still has a few issues left at the end of the day, given that indeterminism itself doesn't necessarily allow any more room for free will than determinism. Right? So that's it. That's really all I want to say. I mean, just to give you a sketch of the main argument, what the premises mean, how people have interpreted the conclusion, how people have returned to the premises to tweak them a bit so that they get a more palatable conclusion. And obviously, there's still a lot of questions left, that some of which have worried people for ages. People still making moves in this debate, right? New neuroscience evidence sort of digs up the debate again and again. Evidence of the relationship between neurons firing and conscious decisions, right? Plenty of further issues then in terms of the best version of compatibilism, whether in fact we can recover all our ethical practices from versions of compatibilism, whether there's any hope for incompatibilism, and so on. Okay, so I'm going to say a little bit afterwards just about the BSc programs, but if you're brave enough, feel free to ask any questions about what I've just said just now. Right. You're most welcome. We've got a few minutes. If there's any burning point you wanted to raise, yeah.
So you discussed about supervenience and about physical and psychological questions. Surely one of the conditions of supervenience is that if the psychological supervenes with the physical,
yeah,
then the only reason is there a change in the psychological level, is there a change in the physical level. But if the physical level is purely deterministic, then how can psychological level be not deterministic if it's supervenience?
Right, now that's a good question, and you've sort of cut to quite a tricky point of what I was just saying. So I think the argument rests on the fact that different physical processes may have at the higher level the same physical scenario, right? So you can imagine a particular psychological state potentially being underridden by different neuronal states, right? So now that we have these different neuronal states, it means that they may evolve in different ways, right? So we start with these variety of neuronal states that amount to the same psychological state, but these neuronal states may then diverge, right? So the psychological state then may lead to, there may be different possibilities for where the psychological state diverges. But that's a good question. Yeah.
It's not just create another way of saying dualism, essentially. There's no difference between saying a superior or free psychological state or free soul as such. So it might be choose what dualism is.
So the issue of the relationship between mental states, conscious feelings and so on, and physical states is implicated in this debate about free will. I agree, right? And the main sort of positions with respect to that relationship are indeed dualism, that mental states are something different and sort of interact in some strange way with mental states. Or physicalism, which is just that, it's just physical stuff and kind of
how experiences are just physical. Right? It's kind of hard to get your head around, but you know what I mean. So if that's implicated in the debate, you might think some of this debate is relying on physicalism, right? And that maybe if we acknowledge dualism, that mental states are not part of the physical world, we sort of get out of a lot of these problems. Now, I think some people have raised some very good... some people have sort of tackled this issue head on and have turned it rather into a logical problem to do with causation, right, rather than specifically about physical causation. And that, in fact, the problem is just, at the end of the day, we can't cause ourselves, whether that causation is happening at the mental level or at the physical level. So the basic point is, even if you move to having two types of matter, mental and physical, you're going to be left at the end of the day with the same puzzle, right? Either the world's deterministic in some combinatorial fashion between mental and physical, or it's indeterministic, but either way, how do we sort of get to be causes of our character in a way that ultimate blame and praise seems to rest on? Right? But anyway, that's also a good question and one that has been pursued in the literature, like, what avenues does a different conception of the relationship between mind and body open up? Yeah, one more, I think. Yeah.
How do you moral responsibility, assigning praise and blame, can't you use almost emotivist stance? And like P.F. Strawson's argument that it's so human for us to have a reaction to someone, if someone pushes you over, you're immediately going to be like, what are you doing? And then you can't avoid that. It's so human that even if we say there is no free will, it's all determined, you can still assign praise and blame because it's there. We live with it. It's so human that it has to be there.
Yeah, yeah. So, and moreover, we're just, like, we evaluate a painting, we evaluate other people.
Yeah.
Like, we don't care if they cause themselves or if they're ultimately, you know, the author of themselves. Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, and Strawson would be a classic compatibilist or working within a compatibilist.
So that is compatibilist.
Yeah. So, and actually, many ethicists, there are a bunch of people I'm not too concerned about. They were compatibilists long ago, and that it's not so, you know, they're happy with that. They think that most of our ethical practices, or the ones that we should stick to, make sense within this compatibilist framework. Right. But then I think they should do a little more work explaining, making some distinctions. So you don't want to lose the distinction between the addict and the person who has coolly reflected on their actions. Right. So the task for compatibilists then is to sort of make some further discriminations, all within the bounds of determinism.
Yeah.
To be able to pick out the special cases of moral responsibility that we do indeed pick out as different, right?
Which is very hard.
Yeah, it's hard, but that's fine. It's a project in itself. There's more to be said for the compatibilists. They still have tasks to do, even if they're like, yeah, this free will business. A lot of nonsense, really. You know, why isn't everyone just a compatibilist and get on with it?
Can I ask one more question?
I think I should move on because I want to also allow, because you can over afternoon tea, and I'd be most happy to answer further questions from anyone about this over afternoon tea. But again, I don't necessarily think I need to show you this information, you know, what our programs are, but just to prompt you in case there's further questions you wanted to ask me now in the remaining couple of minutes, or just to jog your mind in case there's something that you'd like to ask people over afternoon tea. So they're the courses we have available that you would have been accepted onto one or the other of. Flossian economics, fairly constrained degree because you have to do all the necessary economics options, and the philosophy options, bit of a tricky choice as to whether you take the more maths-heavy options in your first year. Other than that, you have limited extra options, I'm afraid. But that's because you're getting up to speed on the philosophy and the economics. The straight philosophy degree, of course, which does allow you quite a lot of flexibility, And also the BSc Politics and Philosophy, which is actually administered by the government department. Again, fairly constrained because you have to take the required political science, political theory courses and the philosophy courses. Right. Our list of further options is growing year by year with the department faculty list, basically. And you can read about them on the webpage. We're also moving to more half-unit options so that there's a bit more flexibility in your program, matching different half-units. And that's all I want to say. We should head over shortly to